Hello? Yes? Okay? Good evening. It's pretty helpful in our lives to deliberately make time to be at peace. I don't know about you guys, but I can find life rather difficult sometimes. And to the degree that we kind of separate ourselves from that difficulty, it actually makes it worse. So while it's tempting to maybe see if we can't find some way to get rid of the difficulty, it's actually not very effective. That's not to say we can't make changes in our lives if we need to, but sometimes that's not possible. And our karma is such that we do tend to experience difficulty as, you know, happening to me. Oh, this is happening to me. Oh, what a drag. And to the degree that we haven't actually really, really examined who me is, again, it will make things difficult. It will make what is difficult even more difficult. So, me is a kind of baggage that we bring with us. That we carry into the various circumstances of our lives. And that can be quite a burden. So our ancestors advised us to use that old expression to turn the light back and shine this way to illuminate me. And my gracious hosts, Jim and Karen, are kind enough to feed me dinner and when I visit someone's house, I usually I can't resist looking at what books they have and what they're reading. And Jim is reading a, to me, completely indigestible book with very small print, very many pages, and there's a little synopsis on the back, which was like the first couple of sentences from the introduction. And this gentleman, who's the same person who's the subject of the New Yorker article that Jim mentioned, he said something like, no one has ever had, or I guess been, a self. And that's basically what the entire book's about. So you can skip the other 800 pages and
or read the short article,
which is much easier to digest. So it was interesting that this contemporary philosopher comes to the same conclusion that Shakyamuni Buddha came to 2.5 millennia ago. So he develops his argument in various very elaborate ways. But again, the essence was that me is a process, not a person. A constantly unfolding reflection of what's happening in the world around us. And the consistency of this process, to use another ancient image, is like whirling a torch in the dark, such that it looks like a circle. But in fact, it's actually one point of light moving rapidly. And what we call me is just like that. So it's great good news that no one has ever had or found or been a self. But as an intellectual proposition, it's only so helpful. We actually need to be able to see the torch that is moving and creating a circle. Another way this is talked about in Buddhism is to declare that all phenomena, including the phenomena of me, are empty. I don't know if some of you use Twitter. I realize that's already old hat, but one of the I guess entities I follow is Lion's Roar magazine. And recently, Lion's Roar came up with an excerpt from one of the Dalai Lama's books. Personally, I rather doubt that he actually writes any books, but he has people who gather up his talks and so forth, and periodically a book comes out. But just recently, this excerpt from Lion's Roar from one of the Dalai Lama's books had a very succinct presentation of emptiness. So if you have that magazine, you might look that up and maybe share it with each other. It makes what could be a very difficult topic quite simple, quite straightforward. And I think the same magazine had an excerpt from one of Suzuki Roshi's books, which he also did not write, but other people compiled for him. And probably all of you have your own copy of Not Always So. If not, run out and get one. Suzuki Roshi also speaks about emptiness from the Zen perspective. And he uses an expression I don't think I've seen anybody else use. Namely, he says, when we practice, we can discover ourselves to be receiving letters from emptiness. When the mind is, can be coaxed away from its habitual world building, which is what the mind does all the time, we can find ourselves surprised and delighted to receive a letter from emptiness. Namely, a sense, even that's not the right word. Some part of our being vibrates with the recognition that phenomena are empty, cannot and do not exist by themselves. And that includes all of us. So to encourage the mind, which I think Suzuki Roshi, as do many others, uses the expression thinking mind, something like that, to encourage the thinking mind to lay off world building, we still the body. The body, which is in basically pretty much constant motion from birth to death, including when we're asleep. So we take the really extraordinary step of being deliberately still, so that how we apprehend the world changes to the extent that some part of our being vibrates in recognition. Oh, things aren't the way I thought they were. The Dalai Lama says, I forget what he was doing. Maybe when I was giving a talk here a couple of months ago, I said, maybe it wasn't here. I said I was crossing the street. Anybody remember that? And yeah, that was here. Okay. So the Dalai Lama said he had a similar moment where he was suddenly struck by the inarguable truth that things are indeed empty. That is, everything is leaning on something else in order to be, as are all of us. And being a Gelugpa Lama, he goes into some detail, and basically, in a simplified version, presents the teaching of the great Acharya Nagarjuna, sometimes called the Second Buddha, and who in a number of very, very brilliant texts expresses the impossibility that anything exists from its own side. His most famous work, you probably know, is the Mula Madhyamaka Karika, the root verses on the middle way. And in that amazing text, he goes through examining aspects of our experience and using this this rather merciless logic. First of all, usually starts off by looking at the assumption that such and such is true. For instance, he starts, I believe, looking at movement. He says, if you assume that movement is true, and then he goes through a series of steps which finally leads one to an absolutely absurd and untenable position, thereby demonstrating that the assumption that there is such a thing as movement, that movement literally exists, is untenable. And as I think I've said before, the Gelugpas in particular oblige all of their monastics to go through these texts and each of them comes to the point of recognizing the absurdity of these positions that mostly we humans don't question. Now for them, this is the preparation for Tantra. So first they exhaust the intellect, and then from that relatively free position begin Tantra practice, which, as you probably know, involves a lot of visualization and elaborate sadhanas or rituals, identifying with various tutelary deities such as Manjushri or Kuan Yin, Avalokiteshvara. And each of those meditations generally ends with a period of abiding in emptiness, which is basically what we do in Zazen. Did y'all know that? Practice of Zazen is abiding in emptiness. And the really astonishing thing is that everything that we call a phenomenon is actually nothing other than a letter from emptiness. So the Dalai Lama clearly expresses the point of view that is traditional for those who make these studies. If you take any phenomenon, and assume, as is the usual worldly view, that whatever this is does have inherent existence, you should proceed to examine it very carefully. And realize that if it does have inherent existence, that should become clearer under analysis. However, you will find that that is not the case. And the more closely we analyze phenomena that we assume are self-existent, the more we discover there's nothing there. And as I was reading these various teachings from two great Dharma masters, for some reason there came to my mind, I think it's from First Letter to the Corinthians, I think, chapter 15, where Paul says this very, very famous quote, something like, "O grave, where is thy victory? O death, where is thy sting?" So once the veil of inherent existence is penetrated, then indeed death loses its sting. A friend of mine the other day said, we're about the same age, and we were talking about death, as people my age tend to do. And he said, "I'm kind of looking forward to it." I thought, oh, that's pretty cool. And I wasn't looking forward to it so much. And I was contemplating that, and I realized that for a lot of people who have that feeling about death, it's like, oh, you know, I'm up for it. It's okay when it comes. You know, it's cool. I think many of those folks are speaking from a life such as my friend has, where they're very well supported. There's family, there's sufficient money. My friend has a wonderful dog, and the richness of his life somehow made it easier to contemplate its end. So I thought, well, that's pretty good. You know, this is someone I've known since we were kids. So he's an old friend. And I have to say, occasionally I feel a little envy, you know, of his life. I think in large part because he still has family. And and he's pretty healthy. His life is quite comfortable. But if that's not the case, you know, and for all of us, that is not necessarily the case, It'd be great if we too had the feeling like, yeah, well, you know, when it comes, it's all right. I'm ready for it. And for that to be true, to the degree that we have enjoyed, however subtly, receiving letters from emptiness, the prospect of what looks like our end becomes far less daunting. It is simply the what does that bumper sticker say? Oh, something like empty phenomena ceaselessly rolling on. And to see our own lives in that light is tremendously liberating. However, to the degree that we are, you know, we're constantly caught up in our activities, rushing from one thing to another, it may be difficult for us to appreciate what the actual nature of our life is. So we have this remarkable practice of being still. And in so doing, allowing this body-mind to express the incredible truth of emptiness or not self or no own being. So we can rejoice that we are constantly receiving letters from emptiness. And the more we practice, the more our sense that that absolutely must be true is strengthened. And then that's not a matter of, you know, subscribing to some particular teaching. It's a matter of seeing me in its true light. Oh, and also, when I thought of that quote from Corinthians, and then I thought of one of John Donne's famous sonnets, so-called holy sonnets. And he says something like, after but a little sleep, we wake eternally. And death shall be no more. Death, thou shalt die. All this is, you know, part of our incredibly rich human heritage. And Buddha's teaching allows us to see that heritage in its true light and allows us to set aside the burden of me, which seems constantly to be demanding, you know, attention and upkeep. Those letters are constantly arriving in your mailbox. Do you have some question or comment?
Even though using my
there it is.
Even though such letters may arrive from time to time, and we appreciate them,
they're constantly arriving.
Even though we may appreciate them from time to time, my own experience is that that I have a sense of myself as a me, individual being, kind of the central to things. And I imagine that's necessary for me to get along. Yeah. So I have a certain confusion about the relationship of those two kinds of experience.
Well, in the Dalai Lama's article, he makes it quite clear that there is indeed a conventional self, a dependently co-arisen self, and that indeed that's how we function in the world. So when that becomes the object of analysis or study, that's when our sense of me starts to shift away from the purely conventional.
When the conventional self becomes
the object of analysis, which either you could say from the analytical side, as the Gelugpas do, or from Suzuki Roshi's side, namely practicing stillness. Both of those are ways of studying the conventional self and seeing it as it really is. And hopefully we'll avoid the mistake of thinking that you have to get rid of the conventional self so that you can, you know, have cosmic consciousness or something. Yes.
Or maybe it's more of a complaint.
Complain.
Yeah.
Go right ahead.
So I don't think there's anything in Buddhism that kind of differs more from my perspective than the no self emptiness thing. Like, you know, a lot of times after, like during a retreat and afterwards, I feel like myself is stronger than ever. Like it's really brought into relief and it just seems impenetrable. And a lot of times what I'll notice, like when I'm kind of going around in my daily life, like other people just seem like this kind of gray blob that kind of get in the way or maybe sometimes help me. Or, but like after a retreat, like I feel like I can really just see people's individuality and just like, I remember one time I was at Monterey Bay Aquarium after retreat. I was with my family, and I was just looking, and like we were waiting in the line for bathrooms. I was just looking at everyone. I was like, wow, I just love these people. They're so unique. And it's like, and when I have those experiences, it just seems exactly the opposite of what you guys talk about. You know? I mean, I guess I'm going the wrong direction or something.
Well, I guess one perspective would be that maybe you haven't carried the analysis far enough. And when you perceive what looks like a person's uniqueness or individuality, it might be helpful to keep looking and saying, okay, I have this sense of this person as a unique individual. What is that made of? What is that experience composed of? And to continue that analysis until it basically, you lose your grip on it, points you in the direction of perceiving that while beings are, in a sense, unique, they are not unique from their own side, as the Tibetans say. They are unique only in dependence upon all other beings and all other phenomena. So to take on the practice of that kind of analysis can make a big difference. And your sense of maybe having a an even stronger sense of yourself after a retreat, that too, analyze that and say, what is it actually composed of? Is there there's an intellectual component, there's an emotional component, but what are the actual phenomena that comprise that experience? And of course, Buddha teaches that each moment of consciousness is extremely complex and requires a certain amount of discipline to be able to look steadily and carefully at the mind as it's unfolding moment by moment and try to see what am I assuming is true about, say, such and such a person or such and such a set of circumstances. So this to take on that discipline consistently is a powerful practice, which I would recommend. But also you can in a manner of speaking, approach it from another side by practicing stillness. And one could also say practicing emptiness. Taking our seat under the Bodhi tree with Buddha and allowing the light to turn to illuminate whatever this is. And to do that consistently is going to do a number on our assumptions about what life actually is. Yes?
When he said his experience of looking at the people and then what arose in him apparently was the feeling of love, and I would suggest that that feeling is a door to what you're talking about.
Hey, did you say adore?
Adore, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, where does that feeling come? Why does love, a feeling of love arise? Mm-hmm. Is it because you're not separate from these beings that you're looking at? Mm-hmm. You know, that always seems like a good gateway to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In a split second, that's all it takes.
You saw?
In a split second, that's all it takes for my mind to be snatched But I also see something else coming in to steal it away.
Mm-hmm.
It might be greed, cravings.
Mm-hmm.
And I catch it sometimes after the fact.
Mm-hmm.
So how can I compensate for a split second? Or prepare for that split second?
Well, I would say by doing the practice that you're doing now, which is a matter of allowing our presence to manifest while the body mind is still. This is a transformative practice. And the more that you engage in that, the more those split seconds will offer new insights and opportunities. But for all of us, me included, until we have completely defeated greed, hatred, and confusion, there'll be moments where we feel like, I just lost it, I just blew it. That happens to me too. But with the practice of stillness as a background, it changes that experience. So, how about now? You seem pretty still to me.
A lot of situations happen, right now. This is the situation.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, especially anger,
mm-hmm.
becoming angry.
Yeah.
When something happens.
Mm-hmm.
And in that split second, my mind is in that anger.
Mm-hmm. And then how about the next second? Seems like, the next second you notice what just happened. And that makes a huge karmic impact to do that. I'm, as I've said many times, I'm a hate type, so I have lots of fun with anger every day. And I have to... Hate type, yes. So I'm very, very familiar with anger, and I practice with it a lot. And, man, it comes up so fast that... What I can do is, okay, that was a moment of anger. Now I'm noticing what's happening. And now it's different. This is how it works. So just that noticing makes a huge difference. And it's really good if we can be patient with that process. And the more we're patient with it, the more something changes in our heart. So, it's best not to be in a hurry. At least I have certainly found that to be the case. Yes.
I've been reading a book by Sam Keen called The Disappearing Spoon.
The Disappearing Spoon?
The Disappearing Spoon. It's okay. A chemistry. It's a history of the world through the periodic table of the elements.
Oh,
and it describes an atom. Should we be able to magnify the size of an atom to be that of a stadium,
mm-hmm.
such as, any stadium, doesn't really matter.
Right.
The nucleus would be the size of a tennis ball on the 50-yard line, presumably in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
But what I'm wanting to say is that our occurrence of the atom, the size of a stadium, would be that we couldn't enter because the electrons in the outer shell would be going so fast that they would occur as a wall.
Yeah.
And it occurs to me that perhaps we are like electrons, where we think we're the whole atom, but in fact we're just, you know, I hear you talk about that point of a lit stick that looks like a circle.
A circle, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And this might just, you know, I bring this up to say, yeah, and this, you know, but my question is, how important is it for me to distinguish myself as that moving electron instead of the whole shell?
Hmm.
You know, it's sort of like, can I not take the shortcut and treat it as a wall? I can't get into that stadium.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to if I were to go really fast, you know, and be able to use my imagination. I'm questioning the merit of understanding everything, and perhaps the merit, instead of taking the shortcut and saying I can't go in there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say, you know, let the stillness teach you. This practice of stillness, let it teach you. So in other words, don't try to use it to derive some particular insight. Let the stillness be established in your body mind, and from that experience, a different perspective on the world and on yourself will arise without your having to construct it. So in that sense, this practice is extremely simple. And when we're told, you know what, just sit there. That's the whole of it, right there. And it usually takes quite a while for us to appreciate that that's what they meant. Just sit there. And allow that karmically radical posture to inform your life. And it will happen. And then each of us will probably have one of those moments when we're crossing the street and we realize that Buddha wasn't kidding.
Well, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, you can. Mm-hmm. Well, this reminds me, probably 2-3 years ago, I was with Mary Mosin and others, and we were eating lunch or something like that, and I can't remember what the topic was. You know, do you want cream with your coffee or something like that? And I made the comment, oh, well, you know me, Mary, I don't care. So I guess what I was trying to convey. And lo and behold, months and months and months later, this came back to me and Doka-san, and she said to me, well, this one time you said, you know me, Mary, and I don't really know you. Mm-hmm. And I was offended for a minute. And she said, well, don't take offense. You know, why don't you sit with that for a while?
Mm-hmm.
And so I did. I sat with that for a long, long, long while. Mm-hmm. And then maybe a year later in another Doka-san, I came back and I asked her, well, Mary, well, tell me, when does a student know when they know themselves? And she laughed at me. Mm-hmm. And it was a good moment.
Mm-hmm. So, how do you feel about knowing yourself now? Is it?
I feel fine,
mm-hmm.
but I don't know myself as
well as I would like to. Well, keep at it. Yeah. Like they say, keep those cards and letters coming, folks. Well, it looks like the storm is abated for now, so maybe this is a good time to go home. Thank you all very much.